Welcome back to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, John Bryce of Football Scoop and Irish Illustrated, and Pete Sampson of The Athletic. This looks a lot like the meeting we had with head coach Marcus Freeman earlier today, only that included Matt Freeman of Irish Sports Daily as well. And Pete, since JB, Tim, and I did an instant analysis kind of going over our baseline thoughts from our, it was exactly 30 minutes on the record with Marcus Freeman. What was kind of your key takeaway there? And I will tell you, we did use one of your questions on our instant analysis, so maybe you could opine on that one.
I mean, a coach very, very comfortable in his own skin. You know, even more so last year. I mean, I think it, we've all sort of gotten to know him in different ways over the last few years. And I think he's just sort of gotten more comfortable in the role year over year over year. So that was a big one. You know, I asked about, you know, the durability of Notre Dame. And I wish that I had phrased it maybe a little bit differently, like maybe made it more pointed with like, look, making it like the last time Notre Dame went to the national title game, it was a long time before they were good enough to challenge for that again. And you see that with a lot of schools. So what is it about the durability of Notre Dame that, you know, gives you, you know, confidence that's going to be? And I thought there was, I mean, we spend so much time on, you know, bemoaning the lack of a Jeremiah Smith on this roster that I thought it was interesting. Marcus started more with like, it's actually numbers 23 through 65, to use my words, not his, on like, that's why this place is more durable. Like the recruiting from a depth point of view is so much better than it's been, you know, maybe even when he got here. So those were, I mean, there's a lot to take away from it, but that was just sort of an answer to one of my questions early on that I thought was interesting.
And JB, you asked him about why he's a better coach now than he was 3 years ago. And I found that interesting because I think on this podcast 3 years ago, Priester, we were talking about, well, he's going to be a better coach in a few years than he is right now. Well, we've gotten to that point. And I thought it was a kind of a telling answer too.
Yeah. I wasn't sure I was going to ask that today. Ended up opening with that question of my first one. And I really enjoyed his answer because he was so transparent about how much better he is because of everything he's experienced. He talked about if he had a camera inside his brain 24 hours a day, it would show him reacting and responding and growing and adjusting to everything. You could tell he's done some stuff to make himself uncomfortable, the way he's talked about making his players uncomfortable to help them grow. He's also very much bought into his team glory over self glory. He never makes it about himself. He's also, as we know, he's visited with Mike Tomlin. If I'm not mistaken, he spent some quality time last summer with Sean Payton. I know some people felt that that really paid dividends for Marcus Freeman. So I just think that he's proved as a head coach what made him so good as a defensive coordinator, and that is he's always looking to grow, evolve, learn, and get better.
It, you know, Pete, we opened the instant analysis talking about your question. You said durability. I used the word sustainability. You know, this is something that I've written about and talked about in podcasts before. That, and I told Marcus Freeman that this is the deepest Notre Dame team since the Holtz era. I don't know if he didn't believe that or was amused by that, but, you know, I don't think there's any doubt. Like when you say deep, I mean, they've always had the same amount of scholarships.
Yeah.
But when you talk about depth, it's players that can actually play and further the cause. And I don't think there's I'm prone to hyperbole at times, but I really don't think that this is hyperbole. The depth that they have and the ability to, well, it was proven in the playoffs when you can tap in to the amount of talent that you have and you can continue to play quality football on the offensive line when you've lost people. So I thought that his answer to your question, Pete, was really telling because he addressed, you know, the recruiting part of it and the depth and the culture that's been created. And then, you know, the development of talent, which is significant, and they've done that. That's why they have so much actual depth. And then recruiting kids or maybe even, you know, convincing kids to make it Notre Dame first and me the player second. He's done all that. That's why it's sustainable.
Well, I also thought it was, you know, he made a good point that I don't know if I think Notre Dame fans should get this immediately and know it. He said, it might seem crazy to people in this room or people that follow the program that not all kids are interested in Notre Dame or have heard of it. Well, that championship run, the run to the final game, makes people more interested in it. And that we brought this up on instant analysis. That's the key to sustaining this. It's not that like, oh, it's fun to go back to the national championship. It's you got to keep people interested and think, oh, Notre Dame is one of my three choices because just like Georgia and Ohio State, they're playing for a championship all the time. No one's saying, hey, TCU just played for a championship, man. I gotta make sure I check out TCU along with Ohio State and Georgia. It's not the way it works. And you could have looked at Notre Dame like that in 2012. No one knew of no kids growing up that weren't Notre Dame fans or didn't have them in their, would never had Notre Dame in their mind in 2012. And then they disappeared for six more years. And when they got on there, they got lit up. So it is important that they go back for recruiting as much as it is for the enjoyment of its fan base.
Well, hey, I mean, you're in Washington, right? Like, Washington. Who talks about Washington anymore?
Right.
That was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was 13 months ago, 15 months ago. That's true. Yeah. I mean, that's, and Priester, I'm glad you had the wherewithal to ask about injuries, because I want you to talk about that. That was pretty important. We almost got done with on-the-record questions with Marcus Freeman and not having any conversation about the four very important injured players coming back.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that you know, Traore and Latello were addressed on the defensive side of the ball, and Ashton Craig, and also Malachi Fields. John Bryce was the one that first informed us of his injury that he had to deal with. He wasn't here in the spring, so we didn't see any of his recovery from that. But those are four of the most crucial guys. You know, Craig is really the last piece to the puzzle as you look at the starting lineup on the offensive line, and a huge one because they love him. He's the reason that Zeke Correll left Notre Dame, because they were going to give him the starting job in 2024. And we frequently say ahead of schedule, maybe prematurely at times, but, and really, you know, Marcus Freeman wrapped up the spring 6 weeks ago and said these guys were fully cleared heading into the spring. We're now 6 weeks into it. They're 6 weeks further along in their recovery. And Traore and Botello are huge key components to the defensive end position. Craig at center, and Malachi Fields is going to be the most targeted player among the receivers.
And just real quickly on the Malachi Fields, we reported several weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago at this point, it was a sports hernia, is my understanding. So a sports hernia that required surgery. He wasn't going to be at Notre Dame in the spring regardless. But Marcus Freeman today indicating that he's very confident that Fields and that entire quartet will be 100% full go. His quote was 100% confidence that they'll be ready to go for the first game. And then just cleaning up real quickly on the previous question. Bless you, SEC and recruits, more recruits taking notice. I made this point on Instant Analysis. I just don't think it can be driven home enough. Notre Dame won four games last year in the heart of SEC territory and then played very valiantly for the national championship also in Georgia's backyard. And so I think that's significant. It's not just that Notre Dame went and competed for a national championship. It's that along the way, they won games in SEC territory that helped them elevate their profile, especially among that demographic, those young kids.
I won't belabor my question about, I kind of asked him about the difference between having an experienced quarterback and the young guys, and how does that inform his offseason? We didn't touch on this part of Instant Analysis, guys. I think it was Matt Freeman followed up with, did you learn anything from your last quarterback derby? Which, that was a really good question, because Buckner and Pine doesn't remind people of Carr and Minshew right now, but it could have, because people were super high on Buckner. Coach Freeman mentioned he kind of went into that thinking this is Buckner's job, and what he learned is don't go into it thinking it's anybody's job.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the best questions of the day. I thought that was an excellent question from Matt Freeman, and I think you probably heard me mutter under my breath next to me at the table there, O'Malley. I go, oh, great question.
Yeah.
And it really was. And then Marcus's answer was great, especially for him to be candid enough and real enough with us to say, yeah, I went in. And his word was slanted. We went in with it slanted towards Buckner, and he acknowledged that, and he didn't back down from that. I don't think he feels like Buckner unfairly won the job or anything like that, but he did say he's learned from it. And again, that ties into how he's a better coach today than he was 3 years ago as a first-time head coach managing a quarterback derby.
That's all part of his transparency, and that's, you know, his growth is incredible. I was a high school baseball coach for 9 years, and you damn right I went into a lot of instances in a competition where I had a preconceived notion going into it. That's not the best thing to do. And that is part of what makes Marcus Freeman so good at what he does. He learns from experiences and mistakes like no coach that I've ever seen.
Pete, USC did come up, as you might imagine. And we talked briefly in his analysis about Marcus Freeman saying basically the any all the time, anywhere, anytime was the response. But I think I'm really glad that question came up because I thought that might be safe for the off the record portion. But it's good to get some on the record for Marcus Freeman. And he gave a pretty definitive answer.
Yeah, it's I would have asked that if John didn't, because it I mean, it's kind of the news of the now with around Notre Dame football. And it's, you know, I want to keep playing this series. I think the only, you know, definitively, I want to keep playing it every year. The only, I think, wiggle room he offered was it doesn't necessarily need to be like in October here and in November there. Right. If you want to move it around, you can move it around. I mean, he didn't even say like, I don't know if he said explicitly it needed to be on campus, but if you're going to play it every year, it's not like you're going to play this in Atlanta and Vegas. So I think that sort of goes without saying. But yeah, it's, you know, it's like, look, if Newt Rockne started the rivalry and Lincoln Riley is going to be the one that owns it if it ends. I think that's kind of what you can fairly and safely take away from it.
Zwiller already has a sparkling graphic out with a quote from Freeman from his answer to this question, and I'll just pull up the quote here. Where I feel about USC is very clear. We would love to play them every single year. It don't matter when we play them. I would love to continue that rivalry as long as I'm the head coach here. That's as definitive as you could be. I thought that was maybe one of Marcus Freeman's most striking decisive statements today. He gave some great insight that I'm sure we'll get into about managing personnel questions with a general manager and how it breaks down between position coaches, coordinators, GM, and the head coach. But that statement was as blunt as Marcus Freeman was, in my opinion, on anything today. And it leaves absolutely no ambiguity that he wants to continue playing USC. Basically said anytime, anywhere, any place.
And I like his comment about, you know, if you're in accordance with Pete Bavakwa, if you're going to remain an independent, you have to try to schedule the best schedule you can, and keeping USC on that schedule helps Notre Dame maintain the integrity of the schedule.
Which I think, to be fair, isn't that kind of one of those things like Notre Dame needs it more than USC? I know that's kind of like this social media talking point, but like, I do kind of get it.
Perspective. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why in talking with people, there are different, I think, proposals being floated out there. Would it be 3 games at USC, 2 games at Notre Dame? Could USC end up hosting in 26 with that proposal that's on the table, and then starting a new contract in 27 and also opening as the host team in 27? I think USC feels very strongly, especially now in the Big Ten with 9 guaranteed conference games, that it's in a leverage position in these negotiations with Notre Dame.
I mean, I think it's an easy negotiation for Notre Dame to say yes to that if it's 3-3, not 3-2. In other words, 2026, they have it. 2027, it restarts again at USC, and then it goes.
Yeah, USC figure out, okay, what's the year we play 5 home games in the Big Ten? Well, then we're at Notre Dame. What's the year we play 4 home games? Then Notre Dame comes here, just like resetting that. And like Notre Dame hosted twice in a row due to the pandemic, like, I think you could justify that end, right? Couldn't you, if you were Notre Dame?
As long as it evens out some pretty much. I mean, that's, you don't want to be giving away too much, but the way it would work, I would think. Priester, you asked the under the radar player question. And we got to be clear, he did not say Carson Hobbs, but
you said
Carson Hobbs, but then we got into some Carson Hobbs conversation I thought was kind of fun for the listeners.
Well, because we had fun in the spring with Carson Hobbs, overabundance of confidence in talking to the media, and I brought that up, and he kind of indicated that that may be part of the issue. It's consistency with Carson Hobbs. It's not a matter of talent. And Tim, you and I were on the Hobbs bandwagon, especially in the spring, and I still stand by that. And you got, as a player, you have to have a lot of confidence. You also have to have some self-awareness too, and I think that's kind of what Marcus Freeman was saying, that maybe he has to earn some of that confidence a little bit more. But he was really excited about the way he performed in the Blue Gold game, as were we when I was watching it in person and then watching the replay on TV.
JB, the actual 3 people named by Freeman were the safety opposite of Don Shuler, and he did mention them all, Luke Talich, Tay Johnson, and Jalen Stroman. And I think that's interesting because I feel like Talich's Blue Gold game and the familiarity with him among the fan base has like has him ingrained in the fans' starting spot. But I think that's a wide open. I think it's three to make two. I think Adon Schuler has a job, and then there's going to be two of those top three are rotating a lot.
Yeah, and obviously they bring Stroman in with the expectation he'll be able to play, but neither Tay Johnson nor Luke Talich did anything in the spring to dissuade the coaches from keeping them in the competition there. I think Luke Talich is better in the box. I think he's very close to more like a linebacker playing safety with really good athleticism, as we saw from the pick six interception return against Florida State. I also think it shows that he's a coach's son and has a great football IQ and a very high understanding of the game. I think the belief in the program is that Tay Johnson probably has the greatest ceiling of those three, and he probably flashed maybe even a little bit ahead of what coaches expected in spring with just how much he flashed and how well he flashed at times. So I think, again, you've got Talich, who's very steady, who is really good in the box, as we saw in those goal line tackles. You've got Stroman, and then you've got Tay, who has the high ceiling.
Tay Johnson surprised me a little bit in the Jersey scrimmage, I believe it was. He flashed at that time. And most Notre Dame fans, you know, Jalen Stroman's just a name. They haven't seen him. We have, and he's a big-time hitter. So, you know, Notre Dame fans should keep him in mind, because I think there's a significant role for him. And as you said, Tim, you can certainly have a rotation going there at safety, and I think Stroman will be a part of that.
I thought including Tay Johnson in the conversation was significant.
Yeah, I did too. He was the second one mentioned too. Yeah,
because he would have been the one guy he could have left out. So to mention him with Talich and Stroman, I thought, okay, Tay Johnson is a guy that made a move that we all kind of thought he might have made. But Freeman certainly, I think, backed it up.
Pete, we talked about this on Instant Analysis. I want to get your opinion on it as well. My question I wanted to ask when this email came out that we had a meeting with Freeman was, you have a general manager that's a new position in college football, and then it's more defined now. Chad was a recruiting coordinator turning GM. This is a GM analyzing players, freshmen, transfers. What if Mike Martin feels differently than in my example was position coach Mike Mickens, who you already know is a tremendous evaluator of his own position? And Marcus got him interrupted with, there is no one person involved, including himself. Pete, we found that kind of interesting. He included himself. Yeah. I'm not in charge either.
Yeah, it's four people get a vote, and if it's 3-1, then the three win, and it almost doesn't really matter who the three are. Yeah. You do wonder if Mike Martin, let's say it's a DB, if Mike Mickens and Chris Ash don't like a guy, would Marcus Freeman even ever get the video on his computer? How would Marcus even see him? But I thought that was interesting, because I thought it would be like, the head coach gets the final say because he's the head coach. I think that there have been instances over the years where like he's said no to guys and like the staff has pounded the table and like, okay, well, if you feel strongly about it, we'll take him. I'll remember this, but we'll take him. I think that I thought was kind of interesting in terms of the evaluation dynamics, because the GM is a new evaluator. I never got the sense that like Chad had a vote per se. John, you can correct me if I'm wrong there, but like I was much more like it was the position coach, the coordinator, and the head coach. Those were the three.
And Chad would almost bring them to play the names to those guys, right? Bring the video to those guys.
Yeah, I think once he brought the video to them or brought the scouting report to them, that lets you know he believed enough in them to evaluate, and they would go from there. So, as much as they used Chad out on the road recruiting last year, he did grow in that regard in terms of some of the players that they decided to offer, some of the players that they went after, or the fact they were able to stay in it with Madden Foremo till the end. But then there wasn't always uniformity on players they took or didn't take from the portal as well.
Before we wrap up segment one, I know Priester and I I'll let Priester answer this one, but you and I have the same feeling on this. JB asked Marcus about transfer windows. So JB, lead us into that, the possibility of one transfer window. And he was pretty definitive, as much as he can be, or definitive by saying, if I was forced to vote, this is my vote.
Yeah, I found that interesting too. I wasn't sure where he would fall on that, given how successfully Notre Dame navigated the mid-year transfer portal this past December and really had no distractions from that throughout the Irish's run to the college football playoff championship game. And Marcus Freeman said he believes very strongly if he had to vote, he would vote for the spring portal window. That's one that apparently is favored by the Big Ten. I know from being at DFO meetings in Dallas earlier this month that it's also favored by a number of Big 12 programs. I think ACC and SEC programs aren't as sure. I know SEC programs are more staunchly wanting a 10-day window in January. I talked to another Power Conference GM this week who told me he much preferred a 10-day window in late December as opposed to January 2nd through January 12th. And I said, why is that? And he said, because of checks. He said, assuming the judge gets off her butt, these are his words, not mine, assuming Claudia Wilkin finally issues her ruling and formally adopts the House settlement, he said, I don't want to have guys that are getting $25,000 and $50,000 checks a month from us, getting their January 1 check and going into the portal on January 8th. And so that's why he wanted the portal at the end of a month so that you would ultimately save some payroll money when it rolls over the next month and you know who is definitively leaving or not leaving your program. But there is a lot of merit. I've talked to even, I mentioned it on our podcast a couple of weeks ago on the Irish Illustrated podcast, that there are a number of FCS head coaches who also support the late spring portal window and believe that it would protect their rosters a little bit more. And also, to Marcus Freeman's point, another point that someone from the University of Arizona said would have been huge for them a year ago, and that is if you have it in the spring and you are experiencing a transition, especially a late one like Arizona did, then you have a better chance of keeping some more of your roster together. Marcus Freeman being very clear, he thinks that's better for the student athlete because it lets them learn their new coaches, continue to tidy up their academic work, still have a much greater chance of graduating in this instance with a Notre Dame degree and then going on from there.
Clearly the one portal window, well, the one portal window and B, that coming in the spring, that's that favors the coaching staff, that favors the administration. You know, then you put a player in a position where he can't immediately leave when he knows he lost his position coach, so to speak. So, you know, I understand where he's coming from. I think that's best for the game.
Yeah.
But again, we live in a world right now where what's best for the player frequently takes precedent over what's, best for the game. And so we'll see how that ends. How do you think that's going to end up, JB? How's it going to be implemented?
Yeah, that one is fascinating to me. I mean, the FCA earlier this year voted at the convention in Charlotte that I was at to have just the one window, and that the time frame I think they voted on at that point in time was January. But from being at those meetings in Dallas or Frisco at the Cowboys headquarters earlier this month, even NCAA people talked very openly about the groundswell movement to have it in late spring and the belief that ultimately, while it might tick off some kids in the short term because they want to leave as soon as the season's over and they're frustrated or there's transition, they do believe that it's better off for the student athletes if it's one at the end of spring. They would keep some academic stuff cleaned up, that it would let them to truly get to know new people, new coaches, and again, just take care of everything on and off the field. I do want to just clarify, this is only about undergraduates. Graduate transfers would still be free to go at the end of December or at the end of spring, whenever they graduate. This proposal or this debate doesn't really impact graduate transfers whatsoever.
I'd like to put in a vote as a subscription-based site covering college football that for Christmas bonuses, it's much better if the window is in December rather than in April. Looking to upgrade your wardrobe? Founded by Notre Dame alum Gao Wang, you've seen ESQ's custom clothing on the player walk and all of your favorite players and coaches. With more than a decade of making the best bespoke clothing available, ESQ will help you look and feel your best. From a perfect-fitting suit or sport coat, shirt or bomber jacket, or that perfect tuxedo for wedding season, check out esqclothing.com and book an appointment to upgrade your wardrobe today. Mention Irish Illustrated and get 10% off your entire purchase. That's esqclothing.com. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards.
Segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We start with a question from JJ Post. From my limited experience, most everything said in a coach's media availability could have been realistically anticipated by the media ahead of time. Do you remember any instances where something a coach said earnestly shocked you?
I mean, Jim Harbaugh, is this, does this count when it's post game? Does post game count?
I think so.
When he beat Notre Dame.
When he was mentioning all the players he was so proud of.
That was a tour de force of rubbing it in. Like he, so JB, they had like four Indy transfers and he worked them all in. And one of them was like, really jazzed about our kickoff coverage today because one of the guys just appeared on kickoff coverage. Like that was the post game talking point. I think that was shocking that he just kept going. He opened with the kickoff guy. He went to the backup tight end, who I don't think caught a pass. Did he? Did Ruhlin catch a pass in that game? We just talked about his blocking. He went to kickoff coverage. It was incredible. Oh, and also because of Pullian. Pullian was a special teams coordinator.
Just to clarify, all of these people were former Notre Dame people.
Yeah. That's how he opened his presser. that surprised me.
I mean, I still, like, Brian Kelly going off after losses still caught, like, not that it caught me off guard, but I was like, okay, this is actually surprising. Whether it was at me after Alabama.
On Zoom?
Yeah, on the Zoom. Or at Wake Forest.
Yes, that was one.
Did go after you after Alabama.
Yeah, I got set up by Dennis Dodd on that one. But anyway, it was, I think sometimes when a coach goes off, I don't know if you're shocked about it, but like you're trying to get authentically how you feel about what's happening. And if that means you get run over in the process, like, I think that's not that I'm trying to provoke you, but like, I want to know how you really feel. And if you think this question is freaking stupid and insulting to you, like I'd like to hear that sometimes too. So, but like out of left field, I feel like we're all kind of like, we know how it's going to go before it starts.
Yeah, I think so. Early in my career, I was in the locker room with Steve Spurrier and asked about if he'd consider going for it on fourth down rather than kicking a field goal. And he's just like, no, I thought we could make a 30-yard field goal. So that has stuck with me for a really long time. When Lane Kiffin was at Tennessee and played Florida much closer than was expected in 2009, and Eric Berry had a pick six, and then Urban Meyer after the game came out and said, well, we had a bunch of guys out with flu. We're just glad to win this game and keep moving on. Like, I knew, and it told some of my colleagues at the time, like, I want first question with Lane Kiffin on Monday back at practice. And I asked him something about illnesses impacting play. And he's like, we're never going to blame anything we do on the flu. I can't believe that's preposterous. And so, you know some ones. And then Derek Dooley would snack cake some people from time to time, or talked about Marcus Lattimore looking like Secretariat running through the Tennessee secondary. That was an all-time quote. Or they lost to Georgia 51-44 one year. And somebody asked him about the inability to get the running game going. And he's like, guys, we scored 44 points. You want to talk about the run game? And then he goes off. And then there's another question about the defense. And he goes, why? You want to talk about the run game some more? So it was great. And Dooley once went into a soliloquy about Rommel and how Rommel, he correlated Rommel to fair catching punts. And just like, there's some YouTube videos out there, maybe called The Eloquence of a Coach, that Chris Budden, who's now at ESPN, Chris Budden put together from our shared time in Knoxville. And I promise you, you will laugh and laugh and laugh if you just go watch some Derek Dooley post-game press conference videos.
I think there are times when you ask a coach about, you know, his thought process in a situation, they take it as you're second guessing them. Oh, yeah. I always try to,
I think those times are when, like, they lose. Yes.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I always try to couch it like, I use that phrase, what was your thought process, you know, as opposed to maybe using some other words that might make sound like a little bit more of a second guess. But Tim, you reminded me of
as opposed to how dare you? You don't like the how dare you one? How dare you?
Well, you reminded me of a situation where I was with Charlie Weiss and some other reporters, and he had some comments about the personal life of the USC head coach. And I thought it was, I had no reason to think it was anything other than on the record about Pete Carroll. The other five people in the room took it upon themselves to keep it off the record because they sensed that it might not be received well. Well, that's not my responsibility to judge whether it'll be received well or not. So that one came back and blew up in my face pretty quickly, but I was just doing my job. And if I was put in the exact same situation, I would do the exact same thing.
Very quickly, guys, we just forgot about the most important one of all time, the innocuous. Let's go talk to Bob Diaco after Navy and ask him some questions. And as people are meandering around, he says, well, we didn't have a plan B. And it went from three reporters to every reporter in the world standing around Bob Diaco.
That was shocking.
That was shocking.
Also, last time we talked to him.
Very true. From Irish Rhino, the number one priority of last season's offense was staying out of third and long. Will that be the same for this year's offense? And do you see the Irish improving on converting those third and seven plus downs?
I don't. I mean, this is a team that was plus 18 in turnover margin and only turned it over 15 times in 16 games. I think with a young quarterback, I mean, look, Marcus Freeman's an aggressive coach. They'll be aggressive in situations, but I think that there's going to be a greater emphasis on protecting the football when you only had 15 turnovers over the course of a 16 game season. So I don't know if third and seven, you're going to maybe force the situation as much as you would have with Riley Leonard when you have a young quarterback. We'll see how quickly the young quarterback or quarterbacks develop this fall.
I think they need to be better in it because they're going to be in it more. You know, it's like, I think they're not going to be, I don't think they'll be playing to make it to fourth and one as much as they were last year. Like, I think that they could sort of set out on a series and be like, all right, let's just get it to fourth and one. Like, they're probably going to punt it more on fourth and one this year or fourth and two because they don't have Riley Leonard back there. So, you know, in theory, the receivers should be better. That would be a reason why they could be better at this. Jaden Greathouse, you know, being more like the Penn State, Ohio State Jaden Greathouse, I still think that Will Pauling will be very productive in a way that Notre Dame has not had a very reliable outside the numbers field receiver in a while. And then Malachi Fields can give you the Bo Collins catch at Texas A&M maybe a half dozen times opposed to once or twice. So, I think that there's reason to think that they'd be better in third and seven, but I also think they're going to be in third and seven more than they were last year.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I expect them to definitely be in third and seven more. I do think that if it's CJ Carr that wins the starting job because of the improved receiving core, because the offensive line should be a little bit better, and because CJ Carr is a better pure passer than Riley Leonard, if that's how it shakes out, then they'll have a chance to convert more of those. And to your point, they'll need to convert more of those because you don't have Riley Leonard as a bulldozer back there that you know you're going to run center right on fourth and one or fourth and two.
Pete, I generally agree. Excuse me, Tim. I'm sorry. I generally agree with what you're saying about they'll probably punt a little bit more on fourth and one and fourth and two, but you're also going to be running behind what should be a great offensive line. So that gives you a little different consideration as you progress through the season and whether you develop in that area or not.
That's kind of why I might push back a little on there's more third and sevens with a better offensive line and Love and Price and those guys. If the point is to, I know what you're saying, you can go on second and nine, you can throw more now. So you might end up in third or on second and seven, you can throw more now. You don't have to stay ahead of the chain. So you might end up in third and seven. But I feel like the offense just as a whole will be better leading up to third down. But I definitely agree with you that on fourth and two at your own 48, you might have to think to yourself, this is not a one-man show carrying people for first downs. Because it was so much easier to run QB power than ever do a turn and hand off to someone. I mean, you were counting for different hats, and even Freeman mentioned you're accounting for different numbers right in the box with Riley Leonard.
Well, and real quickly, I would add that also Notre Dame's defense a year ago afforded it a hell of a lot of more opportunities to go for it offensively on fourth and short. And we all, I think, are in consensus that we expect Notre Dame to, again, have a really good defense this year. But it is a transition year for the Notre Dame defense into a new coordinator. So you have a brand new starting quarterback on offense and a brand new coordinator on defense. I do think that may ultimately result in fewer fourth down conversion attempts for the Irish offense.
We have a question from Indy Dan 106. After Freeman's press conference, what are you looking forward to observing the most during fall camp, and any takeaways that would impact your season projections of 10 plus wins?
Go ahead, guys. I have an answer here.
One thing that I've written down that I didn't really get to ask much about, like, I want to know how good he thinks Malachi Fields actually is. Because I think when you see some offseason analysis from different personnel people, like whether it be on ESPN.com or wherever, like you see Fields ranked anywhere from like, this guy should be a second round pick to like, I think ESPN had him as like the 44th transfer player. So like if he's the 44th transfer player, that's not
a second round pick.
That's not moving the needle. A second round pick is more like the Claypool Boykin junior senior years for those guys. So I want to know more about how good he thinks or how good they think Fields could be. Cause everything I heard about when they were courting him was like, they expect this guy to be a stud. Marcus didn't really come out and like go there with us today. So that would be one, but I still think 10 plus wins. This is a playoff team. You know, is it as good as last year's team? I don't know, but I still think it's a playoff team.
I think that's a great point on Malachi Fields, especially, and I've shared some of this on previous podcasts. I think I wrote a little bit about it earlier in the year as well, back in January when I was at the AFCA convention and got a chance to visit with a number of ACC coaches, assistants, and otherwise. And they were all overall very complimentary of Fields, but there was some indication that at times he could disappear in games. And so somebody said, are you getting the guy that is Notre Dame getting the guy that was there the first five games of 2024 or the last seven games of 2024? The indication being that the first half Malachi Fields was much better than the second half of the season Malachi Fields. Now we know by the end of the year, he was dinged up and injured and had to have that surgery. But I'm with Pete. Like, if he looks like he could have a Chase Claypool type of production this year, and I think you're right, Pete. I think ESPN had him 41, 42, 44, somewhere along there. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anybody telling me at AFCA that they think he could challenge to be a first or second round draft pick, but that he is a very nice college football receiver. So that's one. But no, I mean, nothing that I heard today dissuades me from thinking this absolutely should be a team that controls its destiny to make the playoffs again this year.
I guess the question I would have, Tim, excuse me for a second, but you know, if Malachi Fields disappeared, was that Malachi Fields or was that the lousy quarterback play they had the last couple of years?
You didn't like the Calandria era?
Well, I thought I kind of like Calandria going into the Notre Dame Virginia game, but I didn't like him coming out of that. JB, those ACC people would know better than I mainly have seen, you know, highlight stuff of Malachi Fields, but I still feel like he is a better, more consistent Bo Collins. Yes. with absolutely better hands than Bo Collins.
The question, one of the main questions I wanted to ask Marcus was actually someone submitted it on Twitter too. So I want to go ahead and give a shout out to Kenny Covington. The experience of Sam Hartman and Riley Leonard versus what going through the whole summer, what you have now with inexperienced players. That's what I want to watch now. Does this change anything? I need to see when the starter is chosen, how definitively that happens. I assume it will be quick. Does anybody push back on they will choose their starter quickly? I think that'll be quick and you'll move on with life. I want to see if being a year and a half in the system is more important than having all the experience that Riley Leonard had. Cause I thought that was a great point by Marcus that pushed back on my exact question, but that's the new thing I want to see, because if they hit the ground running offensively, they're in good shape. If their quarterback hits the ground running, because Jeremiah Love's going to, and the offensive line's going to.
Yeah, I just, like, I expect CJ Carr to be accurate.
Yeah.
From the get-go. The start of fall practice. It's not going to be like, damn, he's throwing the ball all over the place. I can't envision that, seeing that.
Next question from Future Domer Dad. What players do you expect to leave early for the draft? It's a Notre Dame podcast, so these are just Notre Dame players, guys.
Geez, I mean, next year?
Yes. And then you can go into the next year after that. But
oh, God. I mean, Jeremiah Love, I expect him. I think he'll probably declare for the draft after the season.
Consider it.
considering he's already said that he's going to. But, you know, like Jagasaw, Shrouth would be pretty interesting to me. You know, I think those guys are, you know, great house. They're all kind of like on the cut line of like, does this make sense? Does it not? I don't know. I'm not sure where things will fall with them.
Yeah, I would obviously love Jadarian Price could have a decision to make in that regard.
I think he should go to stay healthy.
Yeah. And then certainly the offensive line, I would say Shrouth, Jagasaw, Emil Wagner will all have significant decisions to make defensively. Technically, I guess Boubacar Traore could have a decision to make. You know, I don't think, I guess Adon Shuler could have a decision to make. So
I think he will might go. Adon Shuler would be one of my first choices. I mean, assuming Adon Shuler improves from his breakout season and becomes not just a breakout, but one of the best safeties, I think Shuler would have a chance towards that.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm at on those things.
I agree with all of those names. And JB, I know that you're bullish on Jaden Greathouse, and certainly Jaden Greathouse is a guy that could have a great year. I think it's going to be, you know, I think with Malachi Fields, it'll be difficult for Greathouse to be the one accentuate. Well, and Will Pauling, because I do think he's a volume receiver as well, Tim. But
yeah, I'm bullish on Greathouse, but I don't have him declaring early.
Yeah, when you do it against Penn State, Ohio State, I don't want to diminish that. That is a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment. But I also know that in between, you know, Navy and the first couple games of his freshman year until the very end of last year, 16-game schedule, he was invisible during that time. Now, again, was that Riley Leonard not being a consistent quarterback, or is that Jaden Greathouse? So I guess we'll find that out about Greathouse and Malachi Fields. But, you know, the guys that you mentioned, I'm on board with them.
And Snead's a senior with eligibility, but I believe he will go pro next year as well. Yep. Give him a shot in the NFL as well.
Question from Manatee. T.O. mentioned on a previous podcast that the staff is pretty forthright when it comes to player evaluations at the end of the year. Can you give any insights here? Are they telling players to leave? Are they changing their verbiage now that player payment is more formalized?
I asked Marcus Freeman about exit interviews, but of course we did not get into player payment and NIL in the answer. But I found it intriguing that Notre Dame really didn't lose much in a year where they had to have frank conversations with players. They did not know if they're going to have to cut 18 players. You have to tell all those players you might be cutting from the football team, stay in school, it's your best bet, but you might not be able to play here. They barely lost anything. I mean, Steve Angeli, one of the three quarterbacks had to leave. He barely counts. They basically lost Kennedy Urlacher from making a guy that made a decision. Who else besides from that first transfer window where the three guards left or the two guards in the center left, did they lose?
You know, Marcus Freeman interpreted the guy staying a lot to academics. He mentioned that, you know, think about it. The guys that leave this program, there's only a very select few that end up playing beyond the level they just played on. So he credited the academics. I think it's hugely the culture that Marcus Freeman has created. It's a lot of things. I mean, if you buy into Notre Dame, it's a very comforting place to be for a student athlete.
I thought I like that Marcus sort of like didn't take credit for the culture, because I think he's like,
he even
look,
said
I
said I'm not taking credit.
Yeah, he's just like, look, this is a Notre Dame thing. It really doesn't have much to do with me. Where like the players see like my golden ticket for life is here at the end of the road. I'm going to stick around for an extra year and do that, and then I'm going to go grad transfer somewhere else. I think there's a stickiness to Notre Dame that is pretty unique, that, you know, was true, you know, when Brian Kelly was here. It's not like they had guys running for the exits here. I think it's been true kind of since the beginning of time.
The other part is, I think he's very smart to lean into how much, like, I totally support a grad transfer at this program. We don't want you to transfer until you get your degree. I think it's just a smart way of doing business, because then when those guys can graduate early, Notre Dame's coaching staff can be aggressive is the wrong word, but they can be like, all right, this is perfect timing. We'll help you find a landing spot. Let's move on. And it's easy to say that to someone that's about to graduate, or you have to accelerate their process to graduate. It's a lot easier to say that than it is to a sophomore that wants to transfer away. I think it came off weird last year when he said it, because it was I don't want to misquote him on this, but it was, I think it was about Mickey. And he was saying, well, he's going to graduate from here, so we totally support this. I remember thinking to myself, I wonder how that's going to be taken. It shouldn't be taken any other way. It was a kind thing to say, really. Like, hey, I support Jaden Mickey for wanting to leave. He's going to graduate from this university first. Because that way you are still a player's coach, even though he needed Jaden Mickey as a backup player when he was transferring.
And I would note, this is actually a study done recently on 247 Sports Recruits, and my colleague Zach Barnett wrote about it in depth this week at Football Scoop on the transfer front. They analyzed 1,000 top 247 players from 18 to 2021 and found that the players who stuck with their original school were 5 times more likely to be drafted than those players who transferred. Wow. Over that same time period. And again, Zach's story on Football Scoop has the hard data. You can look at the numbers yourself, but the headline is new data shows transfer players far less likely to be drafted. And then when you get down in there to it, it was literally like 53.4% versus like 11.1%.
Obviously, we're going to miss somebody here because I'm bringing it up right now. Who's the last transfer out of Notre Dame that got drafted? Not graduate.
As you like to say, this is great radio.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Bad radio.
I don't
have an answer for you. Bad radio. So. Good question, right, Pete Sampson? Yeah. There you go. Let's find that out.
I'll break the silence and say I'm going to push back on Marcus Freeman saying that he doesn't have anything to do with the culture at Notre Dame. And that, look, I'm the biggest proponent of Notre Dame and what it offers you and the culture and all that. And that part is true. But you can't convince me that the camaraderie and the togetherness of this football program, you can't convince me that doesn't have anything to do with Marcus Freeman. It has a ton to do with him. We have a question from What Would Weiss Do? We hang on your preseason predictions, projections, and analysis, I think more so than in season. What were you most wrong about entering last year? You can't pick the NIU game as an answer.
Yeah. I thought that was
fair
funny.
Enough. Fair enough. And why will you not be wrong about that again this year? I'm promising nothing about being wrong. Not being
first
wrong
of all,
again.
I want you to listen to our analysis in season more because we're more informed. Yeah, absolutely. I get it. I mean, no one has any access like we have during the, I think people can watch games and make their own judgments, but before you can watch a game, you probably want to read about what people think. So most wrong about, I thought Notre Dame would have a better passing game than they did last year. I didn't think it would be. I thought the running game was going to lead them, but I definitely thought Riley Leonard and Great House and the Irish offense would have a better passing game.
Yeah, I thought Riley Leonard, Great House, Bo Collins, Chris Mitchell, all of those, I thought, and the fact that they were so good at running back, I thought would give them a better throw game than what they had. And then even though I somewhat amended it on the field to you guys before kickoff and made it clear that I had picked brutally wrong, I got the Georgia pick wrong on the prediction front and then had changed my tune before kickoff. But I've got to own that one. I've got to eat that one. And I've had a number of former Notre Dame players reach out to me about that one and let me know that I was vastly wrong on that one. So.
Yeah, it's weird how when you're wrong and they win, people don't really let you walk away from it.
The Ohio State stuff hasn't come up much, Tim.
No, nobody ever mentioned that.
We were right about that.
I'll be right.
We don't
get
any
back.
Credit for that.
Yeah,
I'll be right back. Brock Purdy's calling me.
Yeah. I would say, just for sake of variety, I agree with the Leonard Great House passing game. I thought James Rendell would be a lot better at the beginning of the year than he was. That took a long time for him to settle in. So those were. The offense was definitely like, even though Denbrock was like, look, we're not going to be a finished product, I thought they would still be more finished than they actually were.
Yep.
That was probably the thing I was most wrong about. Yeah. And I absolutely will be brutally wrong about multiple things again this year. So
I'm going to go ahead and put myself on blast. I actually had a really good year predicting the summer projections, like the best I've had since 2020. But listen to this one. Prediction number 11, okay? Assuming at least 12 starts, Riley Leonard will pass for more yards than any Irish quarterback since Deshaun Kaiser. He only beat Drew Pine. So that is my worst prediction in the summer series. So every once in a while, you get one. I did very well last year. What is that? Jack Freeman, what's the new phrase? And Pete Sampson, we talk about this too with the Alabama. We picked Alabama to beat Notre Dame by one. we were not right enough.
Yes.
I could not be more wrong than my Riley
essentially Litter. Incorrect.
You're essentially incorrect.
Ah, that's my line.
Yeah.
JB, you mentioned Chris Mitchell. I thought Chris Mitchell would have a bigger impact. I knew the depth was good, but I didn't envision the depth being so good to carry them through 16 games. I didn't think they could go to a national championship game without Benjamin Morrison.
Oh, God.
I didn't know about Leonard Moore. Remember, I had doubts about Drake Bowen. I got to see it. We saw it. Absolutely. Did any of us anticipate Adon Shuler being that good? I mean, that good out of the
shoot. No, not until A&M, where you're like, ooh, look at that guy. You know, that was kind of the, when you get to see.
And I thought of one more. In 2023, the ball just seemed to find Xavier Watts. And I thought, well, he's not going to have that kind of season again. You're right. I was right. He didn't have 7 interceptions. He only had 6. He was really good.
I think this is an example of this for next year. And I think you guys are in agreement to a point. Like, I'm leery about how much they're actually going to miss Jack Kaiser. Like, I know people love the new linebackers. Yeah. I'm like, this is something that really bothers me. I also could see at the end of the season, we're like, well, actually, they didn't miss him at all.
Like, I think by KVA the end of the
was
season,
just that good.
I think by the end of the season, they might not. The first two games is kind of like, remember how they didn't miss Bertrand and Leafau against A&M and everybody was amazed, and then they missed them insanely for 60 minutes and 4 quarters against Northern Illinois. Yeah. And then they bounce back after that.
Pete, I think that's a great point, because the odds are very great that Kingston Viliamuas is going to be a great player right now. Yeah. To a large extent, he already was last year, and Bowen showed that he's legit, you know, going through the playoffs. So I think that's I hesitate to say it because
Al Golden would hesitate. Al Golden would hesitate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I think to your point, Pete, KVA is about to become a star with Bowen, and you know, they have other good players besides them at linebacker.
Our final question from West Coast Irish. This was on the message board. Can you explain what types of questions you're looking for or the types you like to have answered? I've submitted several over the years, but I haven't gotten a good one worthy of the pod. Well, here you go. After years of listening, I can't find much of a pattern. And then he put in some patterns that I've omitted because I don't agree with him. However, he did then say, so help us help you. What makes a great question? P.S. I love the levity. It's fun when there's laughter. I got a good chuckle out of what do you listen to mowing the lawn?
So O'Malley and I have always been the ones picking the questions. So you guys answer this first.
I've never had a voice. And so I've never picked the question West Coast Irish because I've never had a damn voice on this podcast.
Well, Tim, we've had West Coast Irish questions.
Well,
before.
We have too. There's so we many have. Things wrong with the submission.
West Coast Irish, you're not listening to all the podcasts. I know we've had you.
I miss the what do you listen to mowing the yard question. Actually, I'm getting ready to go mow the yard as soon as we tidy up here. So I will tell you that I take great pride in the eclectic nature of what I listen to mowing the yard. And I will quite literally go from Willie Nelson to Snoop Dogg to Post Malone to Zach Bryan to David Allen Coe to occasionally some Hank Williams Jr., a hell of a lot of Dave Matthews.
Taylor Swift.
No. A lot of Dr. Dre, Ghetto Boys. I will listen to Ghetto Boys and T Grizzly every time I'm mowing the yard or going to the gym as well. So, I am a veritable cornucopia of diverse music.
Well, there's your voice. Now you have a voice in the podcast.
I'm glad I was brought up because I want to amend what I said whenever that last podcast was, because I mentioned all the, you know, the great rock and roll, but I like you, JB, I listen to a broad cross section of music, not as much country as you, but a broad cross section. Of course, I'm from Northern Indiana, and you're.
I don't really listen to very much new country at all, with the exception of Zach Bryan. And so, Jess listens to far more new country. I do like the classic country because some of it is so absurd.
Chris Stapleton, you listen to him?
Occasionally, like I don't have a full Stapleton album or playlist, but I've got, you know, a few songs that I listen to.
Pete, you're cutting me off here.
No, the best part about the segue is we're not answering his question.
Yeah, that West Coast Irish, the best questions are the ones that prompt a tangent where we can't remember what the actual question was. And so you killed it with this one. Absolutely killed it.
And I know for a fact we've had West Coast Irish, not just one, but we've had multiple questions. So, but it took a question like this for us to throw them back on the podcast.
Next time we have a podcast on June 2nd, maybe we'll actually answer West Coast Irish intended question. But until then, for Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson of The Athletic, John Bryce, ready to go mow the lawn. What you got there?
JB's Fire Gym Mix.
Oh, nice. That's good. I am Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening to Irish Illustrated Insider.